Okay, last week we looked at the arrest of Jesus and ended with Jesus being taken to the home of Annas, the high priest. And so let's begin this morning just by rereading that last paragraph that we did last week because it helps us set the context. So we'll start up at the top of your page. John chapter 18, verse 12 says, "Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year." Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. All right, so back in chapter 11 of John's gospel, we were introduced to Caiaphas. And remember, it was immediately after Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. And that was the act, according to John's gospel, that pretty much sealed Jesus' fate as far as the Jewish leaders were concerned. That's when they got together and they decided, okay, he's gone too far now. How dare he raise somebody from the dead? We're going to kill him as punishment for doing that. But so let's just reread that to refresh our memory. John chapter 11, verse 45 is the next passage. Says, "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. 'What are we accomplishing?' they asked. 'Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation.' Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. 'You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish.' He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life." All right, so John states that Annas was Caiaphas's father-in-law. Now, both men, as we said last time, were well documented in Jewish history as high priests. Annas was the high priest from about 6 AD to 15 AD, and then Caiaphas served from 18 AD until 36 AD. Now, Annas had a tremendous amount of influence. He five of his sons were went on to become a high priest along with his son-in-law, Caiaphas. So he was kind of the patriarch of an influential priestly family, and they were well known for having lots of wealth and power and greed. Imagine that. And so even though he was not the reigning high priest at the time when Jesus was arrested, Caiaphas was. Annas was who Jesus was first brought to. And so this morning we're going to kind of look at the question, why did it happen that way? You know, why'd they take Jesus to Annas first? And then only after he was interviewed by Annas was Jesus taken to Caiaphas. And I think what we'll see is there was an ulterior motive in doing that. But first, while Jesus was being examined by Annas, Peter was also being examined as well outside the house and in the courtyard. Now, John creates kind of an interesting juxtaposition between the examinations of Jesus and Peter. Now we know that Peter's did not go so well, right? When he was questioned about whether or not he was a disciple. Peter, don't know him. But each of the four gospels, you know, there's not that many things when you think about it. There's not that many events that all four gospels record, but Peter's denial of Jesus is one of those. So obviously the gospel writers felt like it was a pretty significant thing. And you know, Jesus of course had predicted Peter's denials. And now recall that that Peter had confidently declared that he would lay down his own life for Jesus back in chapter 13. So the next passage on your page, John 13, 36, says, "Simon Peter asked him, 'Lord, where are you going?' Jesus replied, 'Where I'm going, you cannot follow, but you will follow later.' Peter asked, 'Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you.'" So that's a pretty bold declaration there on Peter's part. "I will lay down my life for you, Jesus." Then Jesus answered, Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. All right, so that this conversation occurred at the Last Supper. Jesus had just finished predicting his betrayal and identifying who his betrayer was going to be. And then he predicted the denial of him by one of his closest followers. So it's kind of interesting. Right after Jesus identifies Judas as being the betrayer is when this conversation happened. And Jesus says, don't get too self-confident. You're going to betray me as well, which Peter certainly would not have believed him when he said that. He would have thought he would never have done that. But then as the events unfold, we'll see that that is exactly what he did. All right. So right after Jesus said that to Peter, then he gives them the farewell discourse. He prayed the prayer of John 17, and then he went to the garden where he was arrested. And just a few hours had passed. Jesus, it wasn't like Jesus had predicted Peter's denial of him, weeks or months ahead of time. I mean, it was literally just a few hours before it actually happened is when Jesus made the prediction to Peter that it was going to happen. And now comes the scene in the courtyard of the home of Annas. Now, since Annas was the retired high priest, he would have still been called by that title. So like retired presidents, you still call him president, whatever. High priest, you still call him high priest. So when in this next section that we're about to read, in fact, all the way down to verse 24, every reference to the high priest is talking about Annas, who was the former high priest, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, and not Caiaphas. So let's start reading at verse 15, John chapter 18, verse 15. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. All right, so Peter was accompanied by another disciple, is all it says. It doesn't identify who it is. Now, so that raises the question of who was it? Now, it's generally pretty well accepted that the other disciple would have been John, the son of Zebedee, the author of this of gospel. And there's good reason to believe that that's true. John, for instance, he took great care to identify all of the characters in this story. He's the only one that mentioned the name of Malchus, the servant of the high priest who got his ear cut off by Peter in the garden. He's the only one who identifies Annas as the primary inquisitor. The other synoptic gospels don't mention Annas at all. All they do is mention Caiaphas. And so and also there were some interesting first person sort of details in the story, which I'll point out as we go along, to indicate that John was the one with Peter. Now, and then John also in this gospel, he really doesn't like identifying himself. He calls himself the beloved disciple. It's like as he's writing, he's not wanting to inject his own name into the story. And so it kind of makes sense that he wouldn't say that it was me and Peter here. But he and Peter did a lot of things together. And John, as the story unfolds, John is the one who stood steadfastly. It would have taken a, we'll see, as Peter makes his denials, it's easy to forget that there was this other disciple there with him who is actually boldly going in. He's knew the high priest. There's a good chance that he would have been known as a follower of Jesus, and yet he's going into the courtyard and he's making a way for Peter to come into the courtyard as well. And so, it was obviously somebody who was steadfastly aligned with Jesus, who would, have been bold in entering the courtyard. And John was that person. As the gospel unfolds, it was John was the only disciple who was at the foot of the cross. I mean, all the rest of them were gone. I mean, it was John and the women who were there actually watching the death of Jesus. And so to me, it makes sense that it was John here is the beloved, is the other disciple. And we'll just kind of presume that to be the case as we go along. But there's reason, well, a lot of scholars, when you read the stuff, they like being contradictory. They say, well, how could John, a fisherman from Galilee, been known to the high priest? That seems kind of far-fetched, right? I mean, how could he have been someone who was known well enough by the high priest that not only could he gain entrance into the courtyard, but on the basis of his word, getting someone else into the courtyard as well? And so, so that's a legitimate question, but one that I think is when we get into chapter later in chapter 20, there's a connection potentially between, we know that John the Baptist was the cousin of Jesus, but there's a good possibility that John and James, the son of Zebedee, were also related to Jesus, either first or second cousins. And if that was the case, then Mary, and Elizabeth, they were families of, they were related to priests. I mean, John the Baptist's father was a priest serving at the temple, and so there was a connection there, possibly, where John, it does make sense that John would have known the high priest and would have been able to gain access into the courtyard. But anyway, it's all supposition, but I choose to believe that it was John. It makes sense to me, and so we'll kind of assume that to be the case. All right, look at verse 15 again. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back and spoke to the servant girl on duty and brought Peter in. So when Peter enters the courtyard, the young woman guarding the door or standing at the gate seemed to recognize him, and she asks in verse 17, "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" And so it's kind of a negative way of asking the question. Are you one of his disciples? You aren't one of his disciples too. You aren't one of them as well, are you? She asked Peter, and he replied, "I am not." So his response was immediate. And so the one who only hours before had professed the willingness to die with Jesus denies him when questioned by, of all things, a servant girl. And the language makes it seem like it makes it clear that it was a young girl just kind of standing guard at the gate or, watching the door, basically. All right. So the question is, what do you think motivated Peter to do that? What made him?
Fear.
Yeah, fear, obviously. Surely it was fear. Because there would have been other people, we'll see in a second, standing around in the courtyard, including soldiers. And some of them, would have been present when Peter had attacked Malchus in the garden. And so, interestingly, there's no mention made here of the other disciple. He was standing there with Peter to help him gain admission into the courtyard. Was he questioned as well? Are you one of his disciples? And we can't know that for sure, but what we do know for sure is that he didn't deny Jesus. there's he was he was boldly standing by Jesus, and that's what John the disciple did all the way to the cross. All right, verse 18. It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing with them, warming himself. Now, the word used here for fire is a very specific one. It actually means a charcoal fire. There's a general word for fire that that the synoptic gospels use in describing this scene, and the fact that John uses this specific word, stating that it's not just a fire generally, but it's a fire made out of charcoal, just kind of shows that it's an eyewitness account, right? And it's kind of helps you to believe that it was him who was actually in there watching the thing. That's not something that someone telling the story secondhand would have picked up on. It's pretty obvious it's a that an eyewitness account on John's part, which helps lead that he was this unnamed disciple. Now, next, the narrative shifts to what was transpiring inside the house. Okay, so, like I said, John is juxtaposing these two things: Peter being questioned, Jesus being questioned, Peter being questioned again, and he's showing the contrast between the two of them and how they stood up under this questioning, which obviously John not so, I mean, Peter not so well, and Jesus much better.
Well, the disciples have been dressed differently than the rest of them.
Probably not. Certainly not more than the servants. They would have been dressed differently than the officials and the soldiers, but they probably would have been dressed similarly to the soldiers. But it's hard to imagine if this other disciple was known well enough by the high priest to gain entrance that they wouldn't have known that he was a disciple of Jesus.
Well, she said, aren't you his disciple too? Was
Yeah,
she?
right. Yeah, aren't you one of his disciples as well? Yeah, and that could be
So.
referring to the other disciple. It could just be referring to the disciples in general. But I would think that the
That
other
would be.
disciple, was known to be a disciple of Jesus and didn't care, wasn't afraid about it, whereas Peter was afraid.
Well, John was standing with Peter at the
This other
disciple.
disciple was. He would have been there at the gate to help him get entrance. I mean, that's what it says.
That's not what was prophesied to happen.
Yeah, right. That
So
just that Peter would deny
it
him.
had to unfold
All right. So, verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught." Okay, this is on the back of your page now. Top of the page. Top of page two. All right, I'm gonna start over again. Verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." Now, that's kind of an interesting reply to the question, right? Which we'll talk about why that is. The high question starts asking, the high priest starts asking him about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus basically says, "I didn't do anything in secret. Everything I said was in the public. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. Now remember, the high priest here is Annas, not Caiaphas. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. All right, so the way the questioning of Jesus unfolded, it's clear that the motivation of the Jewish leaders was not to get out to get at the truth, okay? But to fulfill their expressed desire back from chapter 11, which was what? To kill Jesus. Now they've got their opportunity to do what they've been plotting back since chapter 11, which was to put Jesus to death. And one of the questions that we need to ask is why didn't they take Jesus to Caiaphas first instead of to Annas? Caiaphas was the high priest. And any official trial of Jesus would have had to be before Caiaphas and the rest of the Sanhedrin in order to bring a judgment of condemnation against him. And so the questioning of Jesus by Annas was in no way official. And so why would they have done that? Well, the way that a Jewish trial worked was that the defendant was never questioned. So in other words, in a standard Jewish trial, what happened was witnesses were brought forth who were testified against the defendant. And the judgment was made based on the testimony of the witnesses. If the testimony of the witnesses was trustworthy, and the judge and jury, in this case the Sanhedrin would have been the jury, they would question the witnesses, but it was not the practice at all to question the defendant. Okay, everything was based on the law of Moses, and the law of Moses said if two witnesses agree on something, then it's settled. And so the judge, so the law court itself was all based on the testimony of the witnesses and questioning the witnesses.
Who would have made the decision to take him to Annas?
I think it was a conspiracy. The question is, who would have made the decision to take him to Annas first? And I'm about
Soldiers and the Jews.
Yeah, so there were Roman soldiers and Jews. They were and the Jewish officials, which, they had their own temple guards. So there was the Roman soldiers, the temple guards, following the instructions of the leaders of the Sanhedrin, which would have been Annas and Caiaphas. And they were, clearly they had planned this in advance. And so the question is, why would they have done that? And I'm about to explain why I think that was the case. All right, so. Given that the way that this Jewish law court works, what was happening to Jesus was not in line with that at all. Because what happened? Well, who was Annas questioning? First of all, there wasn't even any witnesses. He was questioning Jesus, which was totally out of line in terms of a Jewish court proceeding. And so, that the examination of Jesus ran contrary to an official court practice in the Jewish law court. And so the question is, what was going on? Well, it seems pretty clear that Annas was questioning Jesus per the plan of him and Caiaphas, probably. He was questioning him first in an attempt to get Jesus to say something that was incriminating. That way, Annas could have been himself one of the witnesses when the official trial happened. He could have come and said, "Well, I heard him say this," exactly. And whoever else was listening could have also been the witnesses. And so what they were trying to do was to trap Jesus by improperly questioning him and so that they could use the evidence of his own words against him when it came time for the official trial before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. So Dad, it's clearly, it seems to me, this was kind of a plot in order to come up with a way of convicting Jesus before the real trial when it came, in just a couple of hours.
But that was not a legal proceeding.
It was not a legal proceeding. It was an illegal proceeding. And that's why Jesus answered the way that he did. So as we see the questioning unfold, it's clear that Jesus was wise to what they were trying to do. They were trying to trap him in his words. And so what he did was he turned the table on them by his response. Look at verse 19 again. It says, "Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching, totally out of line with what was proper if this was a full court setting." Okay, so very clearly, Jesus, contrary to the Jewish law court proceedings, was being questioned directly about two subjects. And this is what Annas was interested in: his disciples and his teaching. Now, remember that the Jewish leaders viewed Jesus. Why did they want to kill Jesus? Why did they, back in chapter 11, did they want to kill Jesus? Because they saw him as a threat to their authority and to their way of life. Okay, so this guy's a threat to us, to our place, to our, to our source of power as the Sanhedrin, to our relationship with the Romans, which, is pretty cozy for them. They felt like that was what was best for the people. That's how they justified it in their own minds. But clearly they were interesting in preserving themselves and their authority and their way of life. It's clear that the Romans, just by the fact that the Romans sent soldiers along with the temple guards in order to arrest Jesus, it's clear that they had a very cozy working relationship with each other, the Sanhedrin and the Roman authorities.
It says, meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus. That would be Caiaphas.
No, that's still Annas. He wasn't taken. Well, he was the former high priest, and that's why he's called high priest. That's so he was still, that's right. He was still called the high priest because he was a former high priest. But he was not the ruling high priest at the time, and therefore he was not the official presider over the trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin when that came. So all this was just way out of order. But there's a reason that they needed the Romans' help is because the Sanhedrin, the Jewish authorities, did not have any right or authority to execute somebody. They had to take whoever they deemed worthy of death to the Romans in order for the Romans to execute them. Okay, so that's what was going on. So that's why he's asking about the disciples and his teaching. What Annas was doing was gauging two things. Just how much of a threat was Jesus teaching, not to them just as the Jews, but there was, how much of a threat was his teaching to the Romans? And how much was of a threat was his disciples to the Romans, as far as leading an uprising? Because in order to get the help of Rome to execute him, they had to prove that Jesus was a threat to Rome. And once we get next week to the questioning of Jesus by Pilate, we'll see, he wasn't really convinced once he questioned Jesus, because he said, "Are you, what's the nature of this kingdom that you're bringing in?" And Jesus said, "Well, it's really doesn't have anything to do with what you think a kingdom is." And so, Pilate was saying, "Well, I don't see this guy being a threat at all." And he had to be convinced by the Jews to, to basically they said, "If you allow him to go, you're a friend of Caesar." It's really just all convoluted the way they were doing it. But they had to do this in order to get Jesus executed. And so the questioning that Annas is giving Jesus here is all geared towards that, trying to establish his threat to Rome. They had already decided from a religious perspective they wanted him dead, right? But they had to prove that he was a threat to Rome in order to get Rome to execute him. When in fact they could not do that, they didn't have the authority themselves to do that. All right, so the question was, is his teaching subversive to Roman authority? And how much of a threat did his disciples pose? Now, they were obviously duplicitous in their motives, because they wanted to get rid of Jesus for their own purposes, their own reason, for their own benefit, but they had to find a way to present him as a threat to Rome in order to do that. So Jesus answers the question really shrewdly. Look at verse 20. All right, so Annas asked him the question directly about his teaching, about his disciples. And Jesus says, this is how he answers, "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in the synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." So in his answer, Jesus is highlighting the inappropriateness of them questioning him directly. They were, in fact, breaking the law by doing so. And he said, "I've been teaching out in the open, in the synagogues, in the temple. Multitudes of people have heard me. There are therefore plenty of witnesses that you can bring in to establish my guilt or innocence. Where are they?"
But that wouldn't have worked in their favor.
Oh, yeah, well, that's right. That wouldn't have worked in their favor. And this doesn't go into this detail. John's account of this is a little bit condensed compared to the synoptics. When you read the synoptics, it gives more. John gives almost no detail about the official trial. It just says he was sent to Caiaphas and then he went on to Pilate. In the synoptic accounts, it gives more, really the Annas part is left out, and it gives more about the official trial before the Sanhedrin. And they did bring witnesses, and it said the witnesses were unbelievable, basically, because they were contradicting each other, and they were having a hard time getting the conviction against Jesus until he answered one of their questions in that setting, which they said, his own words are condemning him in that case. But here, Jesus' response was, "Why are you asking me this? The proper procedure is for you to bring in witnesses. There's plenty of them that have heard my teaching. Bring them in and get them to testify against me." So he wasn't going to let them get away with what they were trying to do. He wasn't going to implicate himself in that informal, improper, and unlawful setting. All right, so now, have you ever noticed the reaction of legalists when they're called out for breaking the law? It's usually generally anger. And so it was in this case. Verse 22. So Jesus is calling them out for breaking the law themselves. And verse 22, when Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. So, Jesus stood firm against his inquisitors on their own ground, which was the law. Here they are trying to, here the legalists trying to trap him in an unlawful way. What did Jesus do? He stood on the law. I said, wait a minute, what you're doing is wrong. I mean, he was in the right, but they weren't interested in right or wrong. They weren't interested in truth or falsehood. They just wanted him dead. But Jesus stood firm on the truth. Verse 23. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, remember when Paul was getting questioned in Acts, it's what kind of towards the end, like 20, chapter 25 or 26, he was getting questioned by the Sanhedrin. And they, he said something to who he didn't know it was the high priest, basically called him a whitewashed tomb, hypocrite. And they struck him and said, why are you talking to the high priest that way? And Paul said, I didn't realize he was the high priest. And the reason he apologizes is back, we actually just read this yesterday, back in Exodus 22, it was actually against the law to speak ill against the leaders of the Jews. I mean, it's kind of like the Donald Trump rule of Judaism. I can't speak ill against the leader. forgive me, Lord. But so Paul said, okay, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have called him a whitewashed tomb because that's not the law forbids me from speaking. I didn't know he was the high priest. Well, Jesus doesn't do that. He's not apologizing. He's saying, if I said something wrong, testify as what is wrong. I didn't say anything wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me? So he's defending himself based on the law, based on him being in the right and them being in the wrong. And so, no witnesses accusing him. He had not been subversive. There was no evidence that he was a false prophet leading people astray, would have been worthy of death, the death penalty under Jewish law. Nothing he said in public could have been used to incriminate him. Maybe, yeah, false witnesses maybe about what he said, but even when they tried to bring forth the false witnesses, that didn't work out too well. And so, Jesus, had thwarted their purpose in this, inquisition, kind of this informal inquisition. They'd wanted to get him to implicate himself, but he thwarted their purposes and frankly, thoroughly frustrated them. And that's why they lashed out against him. And so kind of gave up. All right, plan B, let's send him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And now that would have been sending him for the official trial before the Sanhedrin and the current leader of the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas. All right, now keep in mind that all this is happening in the middle of the night, right? I mean, it's I mean, under the cover of darkness. I mean, that's the whole plan. The whole conspiracy against Jesus was to try and arrest him and try him and get him executed away from the crowds because the crowds loved him and they were afraid the crowds were going to rebel against them if they did this out in the open.
And this is just a few hours after the last summer.
That's right. Yeah, just a few hours after the Last Supper. In fact, Jesus said to Peter, before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. Well, at that time of year in Jerusalem, the rooster crowed about 3 a.m. Now that's so
Wow.
so this was literally the middle of the night. This is very early in the morning, in the middle of the night, all this is happening. And when you think about what's going on, okay, they've arrested Jesus. They've taken him to Annas. Now, while Annas is questioning him, Caiaphas and the other leaders are having to gather all the Sanhedrin together so that they can have an official trial for Jesus. This is also happening in the middle of the night. By the time dawn breaks, Jesus is already, he's being presented to Pilate. The official trial has already occurred. So just it's something to keep in mind that that this is just happening, like you said, Dad, just a few hours after the Last Supper and in the middle of the night in the cover of darkness. Now, in the Synoptic Gospels, what we have is the account of the official trial before the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas. John, though, in his account, turns his attention back to Peter because, again, he's doing this kind of running contrast between Peter's reaction under questioning versus Jesus' reaction as he was questioned. All right, so verse 25, John 18, 25. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was still standing there warming himself. So they asked him, "Aren't you one of his disciples too? You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" And so, so the scene is still the same. The courtyard, he's still in the courtyard. He's still standing around the fire. There's still other people there. Some of those there asked him the same question, "You aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" And he denied it, saying, "I am not." Now, we don't know for sure whether the other disciple was standing there or not. Who knows where he was at that time? But again, he denied it, saying, "I am not." Now, notice that each time that Peter gets questioned, it gets a little bit more intense. Okay, so the first it's by the servant girl. Okay, it seems like hardly fear inspiring to be questioned by a young servant girl. But then it's by those standing around the fire, which presumably could have and would have included some soldiers and officials and things like that who would have been out in the courtyard warming themselves by the fire. And then finally, it's by the relative of Malchus, the guy whose ear Peter cut off in the garden. So if anybody would have paid attention to who had cut their relative's ear off, it would have been this guy. And that would have been something that could have really struck fear into Peter. And so each time he gets asked a question, the intensity of this the circumstance gets a little bit stronger in terms of generating fear inside of him. And each time he, of course, buckled under the fear. Verse 26, one of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him, "Didn't I see you with him in the garden?" Again, Peter denied it. And at that moment, a rooster began to crow. Now, the synoptics go into a little bit more detail about Peter's reaction about, to that happening and him, bursting into tears and seeing Jesus at that moment. But in the way that he presents the story, John clearly intends to just to present a contrast between Jesus and Peter as they were questioned. Jesus stood up to his questioners and denied nothing. Right? Peter cowers before his questioners and denies everything. Yeah, so just shows his weakness. Now, once we get to chapter 21, we get to see the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, because what happens in chapter 21 is Jesus reinstates Peter to, to love and service, because Jesus forgives him and then restores Peter. And so for each of Peter's three denials of the Lord, Jesus asks him three times, "Do you love him?" So he gets an affirmation of his love, of Peter's love for Jesus, once for each time he denied him, and in so doing, restored Peter in himself and in his place in ministry to for his purposes. So we'll see that once we get to chapter 21. But I just love the way that Jesus shows his mercy and grace by restoring Jesus from the shame and the agony that would have come with his denials and the fact that it got predicted by Jesus. All right, so like I said, John skips over Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin, which is narrated in the Synoptics, and instead he goes straight to Jesus' examination by Pilate. Now, the Sanhedrin trial it is assumed by John because there's no way that that Jesus could have been taken to Pilate without the approval of the Sanhedrin. In other words, it would have taken an official declaration, a charge, conviction by the Sanhedrin, the full Sanhedrin, in order to take Jesus to Pilate and to say, "Hey, we want you to execute the, our conviction of this man." And so it's even though John, we said that John, when John wrote his gospel, it was obviously well after the other synoptic gospels were written. And so there's a lot of things that John, because it was so well covered that aspect of the story in the Synoptic Gospels, John probably didn't feel like a need to, I don't need to repeat that. The trial before the Sanhedrin, that's already in there. And so like I said, it's just kind of assumed by the fact that he was taken to Pilate, that it was done so with the authority of the Sanhedrin. Now, Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor of Judea for about 10 years, from 26 AD to 36 AD. His headquarters would have been in Caesarea. Caesarea was the port city where the commerce and the trade happened back and forth between Rome and Judea. And so it was that would have been the main city where the Romans would have been headquartered, and that's where his headquarters were. That's where most of the troops were stationed. However, during the Jewish festivals that happened in Jerusalem, Pilate and a bunch of troops would go and be stationed in Jerusalem, because with so many people coming in there, they were afraid there would be an uprising and trouble would happen. And so they wanted to show force during these festivals as they happened in Jerusalem. Ostensibly, they did that to keep the peace. Really, it was to exercise Roman authority. Pilate was actually known to be a cruel ruler. I mean, he was a member of lower Roman nobility, and so really he held a position that was a little bit higher probably than his station in life. And usually, when that happens, the person who's holding that position has a lot of insecurities, and those insecurities come out, in Pilate's case anyway, in the harshness of his rule. He was a very harsh ruler in Judea. So let's look at the next passage, John chapter 18, verse 28. Now we'll do most of this story next week, but I want to just do a little introductory piece this morning of Jesus before Pilate. All right, John 18, 28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas. So remember, after he gets finished questioned by Annas, he gets sent over to Caiaphas. There he gets tried by Caiaphas and the full Sanhedrin. And then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate, came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man? If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." All right. So let's just begin with a historical note. Now, it's clear from his encounter with Pilate that, according to John, this encounter was taking place the morning of the Passover, because it says, "By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover." It's talking about the Jewish officials. And they believed that if they went into the home of a Gentile, then they were defiled, and they wouldn't have been able to eat the Jewish Passover that later that day. All right, so now what that means is, all right, so if they take Jesus to Pilate that morning, and the Jews were not wanting to go into the house because it would keep them from eating the Passover that later that day, because they would be ceremonially defiled, what that means is that Jesus' arrest would have been the night before the Passover, right? And the Last Supper would not have been the Passover meal. That makes sense? If they wanted to eat the Passover that night, that means the supper the night before, according to John's account, would not have been the Passover meal. It was just kind of a normal meal where it was the Last Supper, which is completely contradictory to the Synoptic Gospel accounts, because the Synoptic Gospel accounts make it very clear. So this makes it very clear that the meal the night before was not the Passover. The Synoptic Gospel accounts make it very clear that the Last Supper was the Passover meal. And if you go read those, it's just very clear. All right, so the question is, why is there a discrepancy between the two? And there's been a tremendous amount of ink spilled trying to reconcile the two accounts historically. People will say that, okay, in John's account that, the day after the Passover, there was a second ceremonial meal the day after the Passover that was celebrated. And that's what that they were trying to avoid not being able to go to by entering into Pilate's house. But that's not what the text says. The text says very plainly, because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. There weren't two Passover meals, one night and one the next night. There was only one Passover meal. And so, it's kind of a futile to try to reconcile the two. And so the question is, why is there a disconnect between the synoptic account and the one in John? I think that the way to think about this, when we first did the introduction to John's gospel, we talked about the nature of history as it was recorded in the ancient world. And when we think of history, we think of kind of a linear chain of events, right? One thing happened after another, after another, after another. And so for us, an accurate portrayal of history is when things are presented in the order in which they happened, right? We want us to know, okay, this was the order that things happened in which they happened. Now, in the ancient world, however, historical accounts were considered just as valid based on their significance. So, in other words, history was often presented by ancient historians, not on the basis of linear sequence of events, but on the significance of what happened. That was more important than the one chain after another thing that happens. And so the presenting the significance of what happened was just as important as the exact order in which they happened. So in other words, the significance was just as important, perhaps more so than the details. All right, so from John's perspective, who writing long after the synoptic gospels were written, what was the significance theologically of Jesus dying the day of the Passover instead of the day after? So in the synoptics, Jesus dies the day after the Passover. In John's account, he had died it's the day of the Passover. Why would that be significant from John's perspective? The lamb, at the exact moment the Passover lamb was being sacrificed all throughout Jerusalem, Jesus was dying on the cross, according to John's account. And to him, that was incredibly significant theologically. Now, I'm not saying that he made up, we just need to kind of get our mindset around thinking, okay, well, he's presenting this a little bit differently just to show the theological significance of what was happening, and to present it in that way. And the fact that the details, when looking at it from that perspective, are not that important, although a lot of people really get caught up over that. But it's an incredibly important and significant aspect of theologically of Jesus' death that John was emphasizing in this story, because Jesus is the Passover lamb, right? He was the lamb sacrificed for us. And so, does that mean that John's account is historically inaccurate? Well, perhaps from our perspective, the way that we think about history, but not from theirs, not from his, not from, history in terms of the ancient world. All right, now next week we'll pick up with anybody have any questions about that or any trouble with it? A lot of people have trouble about this. They think that the Bible, has to agree on every point. But to me, one of the things that makes the Bible so trustworthy is the fact that you're getting the story from different perspectives and different eyewitnesses. And one of the things that that people, judges look for in a court of law is if all the eyewitnesses agree exactly on every detail, it makes it more likely that the story is made up, that it's false, because that's just not the way the eyewitness testimony works. Everybody sees things from a little bit different perspective, and eyewitnesses are going to have a slightly different perspective on things in recounting the story. And so I have no problem at all with the fact that that there's a contradiction here, and because I don't think it is a contradiction. I think it's just John's telling the story from a little bit different perspective, and he's trying to make a theological point about the significance of Jesus' death. But other people will get really caught up about it because they think that
That's pretty important.
it is an important point. Yeah, that's an important point. That's an important point that Jesus was the Passover lamb. It's hard to imagine that John, even writing years later, would have gotten mixed up right on the day when it happened. I mean, it's he clearly had a different purpose in what he wrote, and that was to point out the theological significance. But again, to him and to the ancient world, that would have been bedrock history. It would have been acceptable historical account to relate the significance of it, and where the actual details were not quite as important. All right, so next week we'll pick up with Pilate's examination of Jesus. And there are two aspects of it I'd like for you to be considering, if you read through it between now and then, and be thinking about this. First, the two big things come up to me that I think are really significant in Pilate's questioning of Jesus. And the first is, what's the nature of this kingdom which Jesus was bringing in? What's the nature of the kingdom? How was it, or how was it not a threat to Rome? Is that and second and then how did Jesus go about bringing it into being? Because it was in a very unworldly kind of way, right? what the kingdom that Jesus talked about and what he was presenting to Pilate was really no threat to Rome at all, because it was not, it was not a natural kind of thing. It was supernatural. And the second question that which I find fascinating about his encounter with Pilate is Pilate asks him, Jesus says, everyone who's on, is on the side of truth listens to me. And Pilate asks him, what is truth? And so, just be thinking about that question, what is truth? We'll explore that a little bit. It may take us 2 weeks to get through this. We'll see. But next week we'll start on Jesus' interrogation by Pilate. So, Lord, we thank you for who you are, for the way that you for the way that you carried out in perfect obedience your the Father's will and purpose for your life and for your death, Lord. Lord, thank you for the courage that you showed to stand before those who were breaking the law and actually calling them on that and standing fast for what you knew to be true. And so, Lord, as we continue to read this encounter and prepare our hearts for in remembrance of your death and resurrection, Lord, I pray that you would just open our hearts and minds to appreciate more and more what you did, your obedience to the Father, the magnitude of your sacrifice, and the power that your resurrection unleashed in this realm as you established the kingdom of God on this earth. And so, Lord, bless us in the week ahead, and we thank you for the blessing of your word and of our time together as we fellowship in it. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.